Well, I want to tell you how much I appreciate. I want to mention two ones. So let's remember her. It's the book of Genesis. I want to review briefly for you the basic nature of temptation, what we went over last week. Does anyone in the audience not have an outline? Tim, could you take care of that, or Don? Okay. Because of the weather, we're not getting started really till a quarter till this morning, and so bear with us. We'll make adjustments for our classes, and hopefully those classes in the back will be warmed up. When we came in this morning, I guess the wind had blown the windows open back there, and it was just like a refrigerator, so hope that's warmed up by the time classes begin. Genesis in chapter 1. Last week we saw the drama of man unfolding. The tempter comes in a very appealing form to Eve and assaults her mind and her will with the desire to take what has been forbidden by God. And in your outline under A, that is the basic nature of temptation. To put a pressure on you to exceed the limits which God has placed upon you. To exceed His limitations. And God has established these limitations not because they're arbitrary, but because they're in the best interest of our humanity. Because it is an expression of His love and concern for us. They're absolutely essential to our personhood for us to stay within those limits. But the character of temptation is to make use of this limitation, to make us restive and discontented with the way things are. And under B, the way He accomplished this was to create in her a sense of unfairness, that God was being unfair, that He was holding back on her, that He was holding out. And so, believing that, her mind was ready to receive the lie that God was not trustworthy, that His love could not be trusted. And she was ready then to partake. Satan had convinced her that what matters is what she could see with her own eyes. Number two. Eve, if you're to really be a person in your own right, you must assert yourself. You must make up your own mind. And that's number three on your outline. And you've got to make it up, Eve, in terms of the advantages that's to be gained. Now, Eve, can you see God? Or can you see this death which He has told you and warned you about? Well, if you can't see it, then why fear it, Eve? Is it really real? Go by what you can see. Go by your senses. See, you can see the fruit. Can't you see how desirable it is? How good it is for food? And how it's a delight to the eyes? And how it can make you wise? Can you not see that, Eve? You can't see these other things. And so, it's important for you, based on what you can see, to assert yourself, use your own wisdom, and partake. And when she does, all the limitations of humanness are shattered. And from now on, life consists, for Eve, and for just about every other person, life consists of getting what one wants and avoiding what you don't want. That's the basic thrust of life. Satan has told her, Eve, the choice, again in your outline, I think it's number three, is knowledge or faith. You can't have both, Eve. Faith is credulity. That means, basically, you're gullible, Eve, if you trust God. You're naive. Knowledge is power. Take matters into your own hands. Be your own God. When you eat under B, you'll be like God. That is, you'll make your own decisions as to what's good and evil. You won't need this Lord anymore. And so she fell for the lie. And that's the lie that's hung over the entire human race up until this day. The lie that a person has within himself the sense, the resources, and the wisdom to direct and guide his own life. Without any reference, without any dependence on his Creator. That's the basis for all sin in the world. It's to take the place of God, to place myself at the center of the universe, and to rebel against His sovereign right as Creator. And so the deed is done, and here's the moment of truth. God has said, Eve, when you take of this, and the moment you do, you will die. And Satan has told her, you will not die. You'll be like God. And so now the moment of truth has come, and Eve has taken of the fruit, which is right. Was he right? Was the evil one right? At first it appears that way, doesn't it? She doesn't drop over dead. She's still 98.6 and breathing. But something happens. You see, death in the Bible is not simply the moment when the breath leaves the body and you become a corpse. That's the end of death. But death is a process, the way the Bible describes it. The fact that you stop breathing is not death in its totalness. That's the end of death. But there's a death that goes on inside a person, and it started the moment Eve took that fruit. She began to die on the inside. And it began to express itself on the outside also, in her physical body as well. And what we're going to see, according to your outline this morning, is the consequences of this death that began. Consequences of man's fall. And the anatomy of that fall, the outline of it, is opened up for us in the first chapter of Romans, and that's why I've asked you to keep your thumb right there, and we're going to look back and forth between the first chapter of Romans and the third through the sixth chapters of the book of Genesis. The first consequence of mankind's fall is an alienation from self under Roman numeral number 1. That's the first thing you see in the book of Genesis, in chapter 3 of the book of Genesis, in verse 7. Following Adam's partaking of the fruit, it says, then the eyes of both of them were opened. That's what Satan promised. And that came true. But here's what he didn't tell them. And they realized they were naked. And if you look at verse 10, when God calls out to Adam, He says, where are you, Adam? And Adam doesn't answer the question. Notice, He doesn't tell him where he is. He just tells him the reason that God can't find him. He says, I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. So I hid. And then notice God's question, who told you, Adam, that you were naked? Who told you? Why had they never seen that before? Why had they never seen their nakedness before? They didn't come into the world with clothes on. They were made that way. You know why they'd never seen it before? Because they'd never looked at themselves. That's why they'd never seen it. And your outline, Roman numeral 1a, they had never looked at themselves. Self-consciousness was born at that moment when they took matters into their own hands. Self-consciousness was born, which brought a sense of shame and embarrassment. You see, instead of seeing the body as totally good, as God had said, and accepting His verdict and trusting that verdict, now they had taken judgment on themselves. They had decided they were going to decide what was good and evil. And now instead of accepting God's verdict, my body is good, it's made by God, they begin to look at themselves and evaluate themselves, because now they've taken upon themselves the right to judge what is good and evil. And now they're evaluating themselves, they're criticizing themselves, and they're looking at each other, and they're evaluating and judging each other. And now they see something there that's not good. And so they're ashamed. They're embarrassed. And they want to cover it up. You see, before, the only thing they were concerned about was the garden and the work in the garden. They were concerned about one another's needs. But now, they're judging, evaluating, criticizing. They know evil because they've done evil. They're in the wrong. They disobeyed. What do you struggle with most, really? Isn't that consciousness of self? As long as you can forget yourself, you do fine, don't you? Isn't that true? You can speak well, you can act well. As long as self is out of the way and is out of the center of attention, you do just fine. I never will forget when I was a senior in college that I was asked to give a speech and I'd stayed up all night memorizing it. And before 3,000 people and several dignitaries, I got up. And the first 2 points of my speech, I did just great. Because why? Because I was so concerned about communicating this truth I had to these people. Then when I got into my third point, you know what I started thinking about? I started thinking about, wonder what these people think of me. I wonder if I'm leaving a good impression with the presidents of these universities. I wonder how I look. Am I dressed okay? I mean, this suit is... See, all this self-consciousness. You know what happened to me? I forgot my third point, and I keeled over right in the floor. I fainted dead out. The nerves got to me. That sense of shame and self-consciousness just overwhelmed me, and my body short-circuited. You know, my body said, I can't take this tension anymore. So I went over. You know, that sense of self just floods over us, and we stammer and we stutter and we blush and isn't that our problem? This self-consciousness? That's the effect of self-consciousness. God didn't make man that way. God made man to have interest outside himself, to be selfless. And that's what Jesus came to restore. Jesus said, if you try to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you'll lose your life, for my sake, you'll find it. Ryan will be dealing with that deadness to self. That's what he came to restore. As long as we're alive to ourselves, that's where we have the most problem. And look at their first reaction to that self-consciousness. They wanted to hide. They wanted to dress it up. And so they were in verse 7b of Genesis 3. They sewed some fig leaves together and they made coverings for themselves. You know, clothing, besides saving us from shame and embarrassment, besides covering that aspect over which causes desire, which can lead to lust, clothing makes us feel comfortable. Clothing makes us feel secure. You know, you ever heard that idea about a man or a woman, you know, they're feeling kind of depressed and blue, and so what do? They go out and get them a new suit or new dress or new hat, you know. And psychologically, we dress ourselves up too. We put on those masks and project those images to people. Why? Because we're afraid that they'll know us as we really are. We're afraid to be known and afraid to know. And that's permeated the human race since the first moment of self-consciousness. And you see, it doesn't end there. The alienation from self. If you go over to Romans chapter 1, Paul talks there about just the what happens when that self-consciousness and that self-interest just continue and it feeds on itself, gathers its momentum. In verse 24 of Romans chapter 1, I'm still on the outline, aren't I? Okay, he says, now he's talked about when man moves his center of reference from God to something else, to something that he's made in his own image or to himself, when he moves his reference of trust from God to something else, here's what happens to his identity. When men give up God, that's Roman numeral 1b, they lose all sense of what is natural and unnatural. They lose their personal identity. Look at verse 24. Therefore, because they move this claim of reference, he says, therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lust. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves, notice that, received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. You see, when you leave God as the center of your reference, what is natural and what is unnatural gets real gray, blurred. What is a man and what is a woman gets real vague. How does a man feel and what does a man do and what does a woman do and how does a woman feel? All those things get real blurred and real gray. When people do not consider human relationships as being given by God, they can choose to make them what they want to at any given moment. And Paul said, what drives people to this indecency and this perversion, what drives them to that is this, the desire that's in them. That's God. That's the only thing that matters. Just one's own desire, and to get that desire satisfied. And lust has some very highly imaginative ways to be satisfied. And so people lose all sense of what's natural and unnatural. What's decent and what's indecent. What's true and what's illusion. And they express that in their bodies, in their relationships with one another. That's the derivation of sexual impurity. Secondly, on your outline, Roman numeral 2, the second consequence is this alienation from God. If we go back to Genesis, the alienation from self, and then the alienation from God. Now, Adam once walked with God. So did Eve. Came to them in the garden. They were used to talking. And now, he's hiding. Look at verse 8. And this is the way man deals with his alienation from God. Number one is to hide on your outline. Genesis 3 and verse 8. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And that's probably when he came to them, when it wasn't hot, when it was cool, when it was good for them. And they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord called to the man. God didn't hide from them. He didn't say, well, if they won't want anything to do with me, I don't want anything to do with them. Where are you? He said, well, I'm naked, I'm hiding. You didn't tell him where he was. He didn't want him to know. He's still hiding. That's the instinctive reaction to guilt, isn't it? To hide. Why do people react defensively? Why do people cover up? Why do people need darkness for sin? It's this tendency to hide. That's how we deal with the alienation. We hide. We cover it up. Second of all, there's the old passing the buck game. The old blame game. Verse 12. Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from? The man said, the woman you put here with me. She gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it. Then the Lord said to the woman, what is this you have done? The woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. You know, I'm just a victim, Lord. That's what Adam is saying. I'm just a victim of circumstances. And it's really your fault. It's the woman you gave me. If you hadn't given me that woman, this wouldn't have happened to me. It's your fault. Eve said, Lord, if you hadn't put that serpent, if you hadn't allowed him to come into the garden, this never would have happened. We're just victims. This is our fate. It's not our fault. And so the breakdown comes. It's God's fault. We're just victims of the breakdown, the mess you made of this creation, God. We're just victims. You know, in my marriage counseling and in my own marriage, I find out that problems can be almost 80% solved when people stop blaming each other. When the husband stops blaming the wife, when the wife stops blaming the husband. As long as that blame game is being played, there's no progress that's going to be made. And that moves out of the home into nations, into offices. The blame game goes on all the time. Just open your ears and listen to it. Everybody's a victim. Nobody's at fault. And thirdly, there's self-pity. Look in chapter 4 and verse 13. Another way of dealing with the alienation. Here's Cain. Cain's just murdered his brother. Raised by two parents who would not listen to the voice of God. And Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear." I mean, yeah, after all, yeah, I murdered somebody, but look, this is not fair, this punishment. "Today you're driving me from the land and I'll be hidden from your presence." God never said that. That's what a person does, though, when they're in self-pity. They exaggerate. "I'll be a restless wonder on the earth and whoever finds me will kill me." That's paranoia. And exaggeration. Nobody ever said that. God moves in to help Cain. And then you know what Cain does to hide? You know how Cain copes with the alienation? Let's go on. After moving out of his self-pity, God says to him, "I'll protect you, Cain. I'll put a mark on you. And anybody that takes vengeance into their own hands will have to deal with me." And so Cain, in verse 16, went out from the Lord's presence. There's no reconciliation there, see. Cain didn't throw himself at the mercy, to the love of God. He turned his back on God and left. "And lived in the land of Nod," which means the land of wandering. Cain becomes a fugitive. And notice what he does. Verse 17. "Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city." You ever wonder where this first city came from? Foundations of the first city? Enochburg. Enochville. You know, it's significant, I think, that down through the ages, the word for burg that's attached on the end of a city comes from the word Enoch. It's been translated through several languages. But here's Enochburg. Cain built him a city to hide from God. And Cain and his civilization, as he built this city, it begins to prosper. It begins to achieve. There is success here. Notice down in verse 19. Here's one of his grandchildren. Lamech married two women. There's the first time that happened. Why did he do that? From the beginning it was not so, was it? But Lamech, that's what Lamech wanted. Lamech made that decision. And it says he gave birth to Jabal in verse 20. He was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. So Jabal got the portable housing trailer business going. Portable housing. Accommodate his vocation. Pretty inventive, wasn't he? His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father who played the harp and the flute, verse 21. Well, there's the fine arts. We got a cultured city here. Enochburg's got its symphonies and its music and its fine arts. That's good, isn't it? Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Technology. It's good. All these things. Achievement, success, advancement. You could just see Cain bringing God into his city. Saying, "God, have a look around at what you see. Can't you see what we've accomplished here? See what we've done, the success that we've built, how we've excelled in these areas? But Cain, what about these slums over here in Enochburg? Oh yeah, well, we're working on that. We're working on that. We've got some decals now we brought in. And we're putting these decals up in the slum areas where, you know, and there are decals of flowers and windows and, you know, city scenes and things like that. We're working on that, God. And we've even built you a temple over here. And we go in on Sundays and we say good things to you. We say nice things to you. We acknowledge that that you're there. Aren't you proud of what we've done? Cain never really does deal with the alienation, the separation from himself, from other people. And you know what? It gets worse and it gets worse and it gets worse. God loves this city. He blessed Tubal-Cain with the skills and with the mind to do these things. God loves this city. But in chapter 6, this city gets to the place in verse 5 where every thought is continually evil and wicked. Cain just can't stop the degradation, the devolution of man. You see, that's where adult idolatry comes from. Idolatry comes from man's attempt to achieve his success and his ends and his purposes without any reference to God. That's where idolatry comes from. Go back to Romans chapter 1 with me just a moment. And look there. We still on our outline? I'm still keeping it here, aren't I? Number 4, okay. All right, let me fill that one in for you. Achievement, success as a form of self-justification. Achievement and success as a form of self-justification. That's number 4. Now under 2b, here man exchanges the glory of the immortal God for images and for lies. Look at verse 21. Although they knew God, here was Adam and Eve, knew His power and His majesty, His love and His glory, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. They began to reason without any reference to Him, and that's what happened to their minds, to their hearts. Although they claimed to be wise, you'll be just like God. You'll have your eyes open. You'll be just like Him. You'll know good from evil. They claimed to be wise. They became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Adam listened to a serpent that was supposed to be under him. That he was supposed to have dominion over. That he was supposed to rule and control. Do you notice how many things that man has made that rule and control his life? That he's supposed to have control over, but yet dominate him, oppress him, bury him in anxiety and worry and fear, turmoil. Idols. 2C, the cause of all moral perversity is the object of man's faith. It's what he puts his trust in. That's where evil comes from. It's when a man moves his center of trust from the immortal God to something else that he's made. And so Tubal-Cain, he puts his trust in his tools, in his weaponry. And the other sons put their trust in technology, whatever else they've made with their own hands. What got you up this morning? What do you live in glorification of and in thanksgiving to? Now what he says in verse 21, they neither glorified Him as God or gave thanks to Him. Everybody in this room this morning lives in glorification of and in gratitude to something. What is that for you? Why are you thankful to be alive this morning? Who gets credit for your life and your skills, your mind? That's your God. That's the one in whose image you'll be made. The third thing, alienation. Here's the third consequence. If we go back to Genesis, book of Genesis. The third consequence is alienation from each other. Alienation from each other. In Genesis 2:23, you remember what Adam first said to his wife? This is flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone. Genesis 2:23. Now what's he say in Genesis 3:12? The woman you put here. It's quite a change, isn't it? Where there was unity, love there, that was a breakdown in relationship. Cain and Abel, born two brothers, brotherhood under B, 3B, brotherhood turns to murder. And then it gets worse with Lamech. Murder turns to anarchy. Look at Lamech over in chapter 4. Lamech gets his wives around him. He's alienated from himself and he's alienated from God, so he needs his wives as an audience to applaud his actions, to tell him, yeah, you did what was right. He had it coming to him. Lamech took justice into his own hands. Notice chapter 2 and verse 23. Adah and Zillah, that's his two wives. Listen to me, wives of Lamech. Hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. That's that tyrannous boast. Who's going to blame me of self-defense? And if anybody would dare to take vengeance on me, let them be avenged. Let revenge come on them even 70 times what was going to be put on any enemy of Cain. Look at him using the command of God for his own ends. The decree of God. God had decreed, Cain, no man's going to touch you. If they do, they have to deal with me. And Lamech comes up and takes that and turns it around and twists it and uses it for his own advantage to take revenge on someone that's wounded him. But that's the way it works in Enochburg, isn't it? That's what Enochburg is built on. It's built on power. It's built on vengeance. It's built on threats. It's built on fear. Because it's been alienated from God. That's how justice works sometimes in Enochburg. And Lamech's son, you know, he's the builder of tools and weapons. So he's got the power on his side. And he takes full advantage of it. If you go back to Romans 1, here is life in Enochburg. Verse 28, from Lamech's act of anarchy and self-justification, from his act, it just follows. It just begins to build and progress to its ever-worsening state. Verse 28. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, and he's literally saying to consider God worth knowing, wasn't to their advantage. He gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. That's a description of Genesis 6 and verse 5. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and ill will. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. I remember in a study one time when we were studying this section, a woman came up afterwards and she said, you know, my husband was in the marketplace for 25 years, And he used to come home and tell me some of the things that went on in his office. And she said, I just couldn't believe him. I was home raising three children and occupied with PTA and taking them to the skating rink. And I'd have a run-in every now and then. But she said, now that my children are gone and I'm out there in the work world, she said, it's worse than he said it was. It's worse in my office than he said. He said, this is a description of so many things that go on in my office just about every day. That's life in Enochburg. When men give up God, they can't live together. That's D. Number three. See, all these things presuppose relationships. And because we're on this planet and we've got to cohabit with each other, it's necessity that we get along. We're not getting along. We're just not getting along. It comes from homes. It comes from offices. It comes from nations. Man's not making it. And furthermore, verse 32 under E, when men give up God, they encourage the destruction of their fellow man. Look at that, verse 32. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. Marriage counseling just the other day, a young lady comes in and says, you know, do you realize how many counselors and how many of my colleagues are encouraging me to leave my husband because we're having problems? Just leave him. Don't put up with that. Leave him. So immediately, that's almost the first response. Just get out of there. Just leave him. And when I worked as a young man, as a teenager, and as a college student, how often I heard the advice, tell your parents where to get off. He says they not only practice these things, they encourage people to do it. People that are separated from God encourage the destruction of their fellow man. They encourage the things that hurt and maim and destroy and bring death. That's life in Enochburg. Life separated from God. In conclusion, do you realize that this morning you have had an insight, just a small insight, because of the capacity of this speaker to grasp the gravity of the problem? But do you realize that in from the voice of God, we have the very seeds of the reasons why our humanity is the way it is? That we have the problem, basic problem of man, in our sight so that we can see it. And the basic problem is alienation. Alienation with self, alienation with God, alienation with each other. And under B, all of man's solutions are merely compromises or accommodations to this alienation. They are not getting at the core of it. They accommodate it. And the enemy is ignorance of God and obsession with the arrogant and seductive wisdom of knowing good and evil. Man's taken upon himself the right to be God, the right to judge between good and evil. And we see the consequences all around us today. I'm going to read Romans 1 as we close again, in verse 21, and let's listen carefully. For although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man, birds, animals, reptiles. Verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Amen.